का था, रूप वही रूप नया।
दिस इज सुभाष चंद्र बोस स्पीकिंग टू यू फ्रॉम टोक्यो। कंट्रीमैन एंड फ्रेंड्स, इन अप्रैल लास्ट यू हर्ड माई वॉइस ओवर अनदर रेडियो इन अनदर पार्ट ऑफ द वर्ल्ड। नाउ आई एम इन टोक्यो एंड आई एम एक्सेप्टिंग द हॉस्पिटैलिटी of the broadcasting station here in order to speak to you again. Since I spoke to you last, no important change has taken place in the general war situation. In the Western theater, the Anglo-American forces have scored a success and the fighting in North Africa has come to an end. The Anglo-Americans have followed this up by occupying a few small barren islands in the Mediterranean. As is customary with Anglo-American propagandists, they have been rending the skies with their boasting and bragging subsequent to the small military success which they achieved. Prior to this, they had been feeling so down and out that they had badly needed some occasion for bolstering up the sinking morale of their people. If one were to listen to the broadcast from England and America after the campaign in Tunisia, as I have been doing, one would think that the Anglo-American forces had already won the war. This type of propaganda had brought good results during the last World War, when radio broadcasting was virtually unknown. That is why the Anglo-Americans have been indulging in it again. They are, however, blissfully oblivious of the fact that the world public is not as unsophisticated today as it was in 1915 and in 1916, and that radio broadcasting has now enabled people in every corner of the globe to listen to both versions of the story on every point. Moreover, the Indian public, having been repeatedly deceived by cunning British propaganda, has now become exceedingly cautious and is not likely to be influenced at all by one-sided enemy propaganda. I have therefore no doubt in my mind that so far as my countrymen are concerned, they will never be duped by what London or New York or Boston might say. After the Anglo-American occupation of some small barren islands in the Mediterranean, like Pantelleria and Lampedusa, enemy propagandists have given the whole world the impression that the landing in and occupation of the European continent is now a question of a few days. When I was in Paris soon after the first Anglo-American landing in French North Africa, I heard from many Parisians that Anglo-American radio stations had given them the impression that Anglo-American troops would be in Paris in a fortnight's time. Those Frenchmen who were elated over this news naturally suffered a severe disappointment when the Anglo-Americans did not appear in France again after the shameful debacle at Dieppe. I am afraid that all those people who have still been hoping for the miracle of an Anglo-American victory will have painful disappointment in store for them when they realize that the occupation of the European continent is still as remote as the occupation of the moon. Friends, you will certainly remember that when the campaign in Africa was going on, I repeatedly told you that for the ultimate outcome of the war, the African campaign did not play an important role, though it was fully utilized by the Anglo-Americans for their propagandistic purposes. You will now realize that what I then said was no exaggeration. The campaign in Africa has ended, but we have not come any nearer to the end of the war than when fighting was going on in Cyrenaica or Tripolitana or Tunisia. The fact is, as I told you before more than once, that the fate of the war depends on the situation in Europe, in Asia, and on the high seas. And so far as India is concerned, what is most important of all is the situation near India. No amount of Anglo-American propaganda can either ignore or hide the fact that after achieving brilliant victories in Hong Kong, in the Philippines, in the East Indies, in Malaya and Singapore, and in Burma, the forces of the Imperial Japanese Army now stand on the frontier of India. During the whole history of British rule in India, it had never struck one single British general that at some time in future, some enemy of Britain may appear on the eastern frontier of India. The whole attention of Britain's military strategists had therefore been concentrated on the northwestern frontier of India. And with the naval fortress of Singapore in their possession, our rulers thought that India was eternally safe in their hands. But the phenomenal advance of Generals Yamashita and Iida created history and opened the eyes of the world to the worthlessness of British strategy. Since then, General Wavell has been making feverish attempts to put up fortifications on the eastern frontier of India. But what the Indian people today are asking is this. If it took 20 years to build Singapore and only 1 week to lose it, how long will it take the ever-retreating British commander-in-chief or his successor to withdraw from his eastern fortifications? We have seen that during the course of the present war, the Anglo-American powers have, time and again, made themselves the laughingstock of the world by beginning a military campaign to the accompaniment of boastful propaganda and extravagant claims. They are now doing this in connection with their contemplated occupation of the European continent. They did it some months ago when General Wavell started operations on the Indo-Burma frontier and marched into Burma. At that time, it was advertised all over the world that the campaign for the reconquest of Burma had begun. But what face could the British commander-in-chief show when his troops had to run back to India, leaving all their bags and baggage behind as soon as the powerful Japanese army began its counter-offensive? General Wavell has subsequently invented all kinds of excuses in order to cover his defeat. Even the British Prime Minister, during his recent visit to America, was at pains to explain away the ignominious failure of his commander-in-chief to retake Burma. But what one cannot understand is as to why the Anglo-American powers repeatedly indulge in premature bragging. In contrast to them, the Axis powers talk less, and instead of beginning a military campaign with bumptious propaganda, they let actual events speak for themselves. When the German forces occupied the Channel Islands, which lie between the French and the English coast, in 1940, German propaganda never gave the impression that through the occupation of these islands, the German army had come nearer to an invasion of England. If, as Anglo-American propaganda is now trying to make out, the occupation of Pantelleria has made landing in and occupation of Sicily a reasonable certainty, why could not the Anglo-American forces make that attempt when the island fortress of Malta, which is as near Sicily as Pantelleria, has been always in their possession? No offense. The fact is that the Anglo-American powers are in such a hopeless situation that they have somehow to bolster up the sinking morale of their people. And
In order to do that, they feel constrained to resort to premature bathing again and again. Such tactics may be a necessity for their propaganda, but that is no reason why the world public, which is now wide awake, should be duped by them. For India, what is of primary importance is not what is happening in Phoenix and Timbuktu or in Nantajika and Alaska, but what is happening inside India and across our frontier. What is of primary importance to us is that the much advertised reconquest of Burma has ended in a painful retreat. That the victorious Japanese army is standing on our eastern frontier. That the government of Japan, through its worthy Prime Minister, General Shojo, has repeatedly declared its fullest support to Indian independence and its firm resolve to see Anglo-American power and influence expelled from India. And lastly, that Japan's Prime Minister has offered active assistance to the Indian revolutionaries need it in their struggle for complete national independence. What is also of direct importance to India is the policy of British imperialism toward our country. You know as well as I do that when this war broke out, some of our friends thought that since the British government would soon find itself in serious difficulty, it would feel constrained to sue for peace with the party that controlled the cabinet in 8 out of 11 provinces in British India. According to these friends, all that the Congress had to do was to hold itself in patience till the British government felt compelled to make the first advance. A year rolled by, but there was no evidence of a change of heart on the British side. Then these friends considered it necessary to exert mild pressure on the British government in order to bring about a compromise. Necessary steps were taken in this behalf, but no tangible results followed. Even the fall of Singapore, the greatest disaster in British military history, according to Mr. Winston Churchill, and the loss of Burma, did not bring about any appreciable change. British imperialism remains inexorable. Men may come and men may go. Empires may come and empires may go, but British imperialism goes on forever. That is what our rulers continue to think. You may call this lack of statesmanship, or political bankruptcy, or midsummer madness. But this midsummer madness has its own explanation. The British Empire has grown out of India. The British people, no matter to which political party they belong, have grown fat on the spoils, the wealth, and the resources of India. To them, this empire today means India. They are now fighting in order to preserve that empire. If they are to win the war at the cost of recognizing India's independence, it will amount to winning the war by losing the empire. Consequently, no matter what fate overtakes Britain during the course of this war, the average Englishman will endeavor till the very last to hold on to his empire, that is, to hold on to India. Therefore, if I were to speak frankly, I should say that it is not midsummer madness that British politicians refuse to recognize India's independence, though they are in a terrible plight. It is midsummer madness that we should expect the Englishman to voluntarily give up his empire simply because he has fallen on evil days. There is another factor that accounts for the unrelenting policy of British imperialism. As the Foreign Minister of Germany said the other day in his inimitable style, the British Empire has been losing one part of its territory to its enemies and another part of it to its friends during the course of the present war. Moreover, in his frantic efforts to maintain his empire, John Bull is now bleeding himself white. The only hope of even partially making up for this colossal loss is to exploit India more ruthlessly when the war is over. Therefore, according to imperialistic logic, the worse England's position becomes during this war, the more necessary will it be to retain a firm grip over India. British imperialism will ultimately break, but it will never bend. That is how empires have always behaved in the history of mankind. Consequently, no Indian should ever cherish the illusion that one day England will be induced to recognize India's independence.
But that is not to say that British politicians will never again attempt a compromise with India. Another attempt at a compromise may be made at any time, whether under the pressure of a worsening military situation or in order to placate the liberal elements in England and America. Personally, I expect another such attempt sometime this year. But what I want to point out most emphatically is that in attempting a compromise, British politicians will never recognize India's independence, but will only try to bluff the Indian people, and through protracted negotiations, will only try to sidetrack the campaign for independence and thereby undermine the national will, as they did between December 1941 and July 1942. The negotiations carried on by Sir Stafford Cripp in India last year did not harm the British government in any way. It only interrupted our struggle for freedom. Therefore, we should once for all set our face against any compromise with British imperialism. Friends, independence admits of no compromise. Freedom has only one connotation, namely that the British and their allies must quit India for good. And those who really want liberty must fight for it and pay for it with their own blood. Countrymen and friends, let us therefore carry on the fight for liberty inside India and outside India with all our strength and vigor. Let us continue the battle with resolute heart and with unshakable faith, till one day, under the combined attack of our friends and allies and of ourselves, Anglo-American imperialism will be overthrown. The British Empire will be broken up, and out of its ashes, India will once again emerge as an independent nation. In this struggle, there is no going back, and there can be no faltering. We must march forward and forward till victory is achieved and freedom won. Inqilab Zindabad. Azad Hind Zindabad.